The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. Well, there's been a revolt in Stormont today as DUP MLAs have by a majority voted against the confirmation of Paul Givan as First Minister. James, just explain what's happened there.
So to understand this process, you need to go back to the ousting of Arlene Foster in a kind of party putsch led by Edwin Poots. This essentially was in part because of the DUP losing votes to the TUV, a more hardline anti-unionist party, who attacked it over the Northern Ireland Protocol and the like. The problem that has, Edwin Poots then defeated Geoffrey Donaldson for the leadership by one vote. Poots' problem is that he was kind of carried to power on the back of kind of the more hardline elements in the DUP. But he is now trying to cut compromises. And so those who are still kind of loyal to Arlene Foster hold or back Geoffrey Donaldson for the leadership hold no particular torch for Poots. And the hardliners don't want him to go along with this because they worry, they look at this talk of an Irish Language Act and Jim Allister, the leader of a TUV, saying that Poots has rolled over like a little boy for Sinn Féin. And so you had a situation today where Poots was going to nominate Paul Givan as First Minister of Northern Ireland. In the meeting beforehand, which Poots left before it finished, it was quite clear that the majority of the DUP group at Stormont, in line with the majority of DUP MPs at Westminster, didn't want that nomination to happen today, and Poots went ahead anyway. He is now meeting with party officers at DUP HQ, and there is speculation that these party officers could declare as soon as today, but they have no confidence in him.
Katie, in terms of the wider dynamics, it was striking that Arlene Foster very pointedly tweeted this afternoon about what a nice day she was having, that she hoped that everyone else was having a good day too. How is this going to impact more widely on the Brexit row and on the Westminster dynamics between the Conservatives and the DUP?
Yes, there's quite a lot of former and current DUP politicians who appear to be having a good day. Geoffrey Donaldson, he was the candidate that Poots defeated, was responding to questions, I think, earlier today and said, "What a lovely day." So it's going around. I mean, I think obviously there is an issue in the sense that a divided DUP party, a divided unionist party is problematic for the government. And I think that we have seen so far with the Northern Ireland Protocol how that has exacerbated tensions amongst the unionist community. In lots of ways it's manifested itself. But I think the departure of Arlene Foster, who to many in the DUP was seen as one of the, a more moderating force, does just show how attitudes are becoming more hardline and solidifying. And I think that if we end up in a situation where there's a vote of no confidence in Poots and that's where things end up, it's not clear that the party is unified on what should follow next. I mean, Geoffrey Donaldson, who was the person who was running against him, didn't manage to win. It was very tight when it came to that vote to go. And I think that the UK government would like to have, obviously, a united DUP party, but also, I think, a more moderate one to work with, because there's a worry that if you have parties hardening, it's harder to create a unionist coalition, so to speak, or to have that broader movement.
James, moving on. Last night, Rishi Sunak gave an interview to Andrew Neil on GB News, and he was asked a number of different questions about a number of spending priorities. But one thing he wasn't particularly keen to talk about was about the government's green agenda and who might end up paying for some of those measures.
How much will it cost?
Well, I think it's hard to put a specific figure on it, and actually we're doing some work which will be published later this year.
You said it would be published in the spring. Why is it?
Yeah, well, because we want to align it with other things that are happening in government and make sure that it's a rigorous piece of work. And I think, look, what most people are looking at is, there will be lots of different parts of this transition that impact different parts of the economy in different ways.
Why was he being so evasive?
Because I think that the full cost of how you get to net zero, the mix of funding, hasn't been set out yet or fully worked out in government, I think it's fair to say. I think there is an interesting thing here, which is that the costs of green technology and green energy are coming down fairly rapidly. I think one of the things that, for example, if you look at Hinkley Point has a very high, expensive strike price for electricity because the belief was that, you know, things like offshore wind would remain expensive. Hinkley Point now looks very overpriced in terms of the price it pays per kilowatt hour because the cost of offshore wind has come down quite dramatically. Now, you can say, and this is right, that if you remember the David Cameron get all the green crap off the bills stuff, but the government did for the first few years subsidise offshore wind quite heavily. But now it is, even without the subsidy, it is competitive and it is cheap. And I mean, the question is how much that is replicable in other green technologies. How much do the prices of things such as, for example, electric vehicles come down as they become more mass produced? In the States, we're already beginning to see that electric vehicles are cheaper. The same model electric is cheaper than some conventional cars. And so the question is whether these reductions in prices from green technology will continue or not. And then the other question is how much of this is done by carrot and how much of this is done by stick? How much are the government going to offer incentives to people to move to greener forms of heating or transportation? How much is there going to be the stick of pricing the carbon that is in the gas that you are using in your to heat your house or to cook with?
Katie, you've written a lot about the way in which ministers are very keen to show off their green credentials without necessarily showing the same level of enthusiasm for talking about the costs of all of this. It's going to be increasingly difficult as we approach the COP26 summit in Glasgow this autumn for ministers to just gloss over the details, isn't it?
Yes, because you'll imagine there are going to be more and more interviews about the government's green agenda. And I think talking about how, you know, it's really important and everyone's behind it, it's not going to cut it when people want to know exactly how these things are going to be achieved. I think, you know, there's still work going on in terms of the government's plan for boilers, which is going to be quite important. And as we heard Rishi Sunak talking about last night, in terms of potentially meeting net zero. And I think that when you read the various things, so, you know, heat pumps, who would get a discount for the heat pumps? Are there enough heat pumps? And you can start to see how things could go a little bit wrong if it's a policy that affects a lot of people and they're being told they have to upgrade, but they have to pay for it largely themselves. Now, I think as Rishi Sunak pointed to, no final decision has been made on lots of this stuff. But I think there is an issue just in the sense that Boris Johnson, I always remember that Sun interview he gave where he said, you know, no hard working Brits would pay more because of the green agenda. And I just think even people who are very supportive of Boris Johnson in government were left raising their eyebrows because they think that is a hard promise to keep. And I think it's just something we're going to see more of. And the technology, as James points out, may well catch up. I think it's just a question as to whether it is to the government's timings in terms of these pledges.
Now, another debate over the way in which society is changing over the next few years is about working from home and whether that's going to stay after COVID. There's been some suggestion, some reports, particularly the Mail front page today, that ministers have been considering introducing a permanent right to work from home as default, and employers would have to give a good reason for why people would be refused that right to work from home. But Downing Street today has poured cold water on this, saying that there are no plans, which is not necessarily an outright denial, but it is dampening down speculation about this. James, how likely is it that ministers would really want to legislate for this?
So I would suggest, I think we should take a step back. People already have the right to request flexible working. Up to now, not that many people have taken it up. And it has been relatively easy for companies that didn't want to do it to reject the idea. They could argue, for example, that, you know, there aren't technological solutions that would allow people to do this job from home. One of the big things the pandemic has changed is you've had a situation where millions of people have worked from home now for over a year. And I think a decent chunk of those people, I suspect, will want to carry on. So you will have more people requesting this right to flexible working, which they already have by law the right to do so. And I think the bar for companies turning this down is also higher, because these people will be able to say, well, look, hang on a second, I have worked from home and effectively for a year. There are all sorts of technological workarounds that we've used to enable me to do my job from my house. And so I think that is, even without the Tory manifesto commitment to consult or making work flexible working the default, I think you would see there is going to be a bigger debate about flexible working and the existing legal entitlements to it coming down the track. I think there is a tension, though, because you had Liz Truss, the minister for, who is, as well as being the trade secretary, the Minister for Women and Equality, is kind of welcoming the idea of flexible working and also suggesting, you know, it could be good not just for gender equality, but also for levelling up. While on the other hand, you have Boris Johnson, who is by temperament, let's get everyone back into the office. I mean, if you remember last summer, you know, he was writing to secretaries of state and permanent secretaries saying, well, you know, how many people in your department are back in the office and why isn't it a higher number? And so I think you are seeing this tension coming. And I think we are also heading into a big kind of national cultural debate about working from home versus working in offices. And it's one of those things that people seem to have very strong views on both sides. People are either naturally office people and want everyone else in the office around, or there are people who say that they get much more done working from home. You kind of cutting out that commute time makes them more efficient. So I think this is a broader debate that society is about to have. But I think there is a definite division in government about how much government itself should be trying to put the thumb on the scale one way or the other.
And I also think it can work the other way in the sense that this is about the choice. But there's lots of employers who don't have a choice because, you know, there are businesses who have seen how the past year or so has gone and realised they can save money if they lose space. And if they don't have such a big office, maybe they have no office or maybe they completely downsize. And in that case, you know, there are lots of people who like working from home, but particularly younger staff who want to learn and learn from others can actually have that opportunity, even like the decision to decide whether they see it as an opportunity taken away from them. So not that it, I suppose, goes too much into this, but I do think it shows that we're entering a new kind of territory when it comes to the options available to everyone.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.